Hello, I'm Alan Gura, counselor for the petitioners in McDonald v. City of Chicago. If you are interested in learning more about our case, I invite you to visit www.chicagoguncase.com, which contains a case filings page with all the briefing in the case. The Second Amendment, like the entire Bill of Rights, does not apply directly to states. The lack of civil rights protection against state and local government posed serious problems in the years leading up to the Civil War. Slave states routinely violated the rights not only of slaves, but also of whites and free blacks who challenged slavery. Following the Civil War, Americans were horrified that the freedmen and their supporters were routinely disarmed and left unprotected against terroristic violence. Not surprisingly, the need to protect the right to arms was frequently invoked in demands that states honor basic civil rights. The nation ratified the 14th Amendment to resolve these problems and force states to respect the rights of all Americans. In Heller, the Supreme Court explained, "We are guided by the principle that the Constitution was written to be understood by the voters. Its words and phrases were used in their normal and ordinary as distinguished from technical meaning." Section 1 of the 14th Amendment provides, in part, that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. In 1868, when the amendment was written, the privileges or immunities of citizenship were commonly understood to encompass fundamental rights, including the personal guarantees of the first 8 amendments. Unfortunately, in the first Supreme Court case interpreting the 14th Amendment, the 1873 Slaughterhouse cases, the court read the privileges or immunities clause out of existence. The court refused to consider the 14th Amendment's history and original public meaning. Instead, it announced that forcing the states to respect basic civil rights would be too radical a change in our form of government, even though this is precisely what the winners of the Civil War had intended to accomplish. The court then held that the only rights protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause are those rights that flowed from the existence of the federal government itself, the right to visit the U.S. Mint, or perhaps the right to the Navy's protection on the high seas. However, ancient and fundamental rights would remain rights protected exclusively, if at all, by state governments. 3 years later, in U.S. v. Cruikshank, the Supreme Court applied the Slaughterhouse reasoning to confirm that because First and Second Amendment rights are basic rights that people should enjoy even in the federal government's absence, these rights are not protected by the 14th Amendment. As Justice Bradley's dissent in Slaughterhouse reasoned, that case reduced the 14th Amendment to a vain and idle enactment which accomplished nothing and most unnecessarily excited Congress and the people on its passage. It is an understatement to say that a virtually uniform scholarly consensus exists today that Slaughterhouse was wrongly decided. Indeed, even our opponents do not actually endorse the Slaughterhouse reasoning. Instead, they defend Slaughterhouse on grounds that it is old. Old it is. It is also quite wrong. Governmental actors cannot deprive individuals of civil rights simply because they've become accustomed to doing so. An entire social structure came crashing down when Plessy v. Ferguson's separate but equal doctrine was discarded. But Plessy was wrong the day it was decided, and so was Slaughterhouse. Our opponents also claim that the Privileges or Immunities Clause was meant to provide for equal protection, but the Equal Protection Clause does so explicitly. Finally, the opposition claims that the Privileges or Immunities Clause is simply too hard to interpret, and therefore it should just be ignored. The court typically does not interpret constitutional provisions by ignoring them. The 14th Amendment also contains this language: "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." The Supreme Court has long held that the concept of due process of law includes not merely procedural protections, but also substantive limits on the reach of governmental authority. The state cannot dot its I's, cross its T's, and proceed to exceed inherent limits on its authority that intrude on personal liberty. Under this doctrine, virtually the entire Bill of Rights has been selectively incorporated against the states. To test whether a particular right is incorporated, the Supreme Court asks whether a right is fundamental to the American scheme of justice or necessary to an Anglo-American regime of ordered liberty. In making this inquiry, the court looks to the right's historical acceptance in our nation, its recognition by the states, including any trend regarding state recognition, and the nature of the interest secured by the right. The right to bear arms clearly satisfies all aspects of the selective incorporation standard. Indeed, the court in Heller already undertook that analysis. Heller explained that the Second Amendment right was inherited from our English ancestors, for whom it had long ago become fundamental. Heller surveyed the strong level of protection the right has received historically in state constitutions, and perhaps most critically, Heller explained that the Second Amendment is rooted in the personal interest in self-defense and self-preservation. In Youngberg v. Romeo, the court said, "The right to personal security constitutes a historic liberty interest protected substantively by the Due Process Clause." In Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the court declared, "Choices central to personal dignity and autonomy are central to the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. If, as in Griswold v. Connecticut, the indefeasible right of personal security secures the right to purchase contraceptives, it should also secure the right to purchase a handgun." Chicago seeks to turn the clock back to a time where rights could only be incorporated if they were essential to the preservation of any system of ordered liberty, without regard to American tradition. Under this standard, so long as a civilized country can be imagined that is missing some basic right we believe is important in this country, that right is not protected by the 14th Amendment. For example, Chicago tells us that England and Japan have no right to arms, and these are countries that essentially have ordered liberty. And this is true, except that England also has a monarchy, an official state church, hereditary lords that sit in parliament, and libel laws that would never pass First Amendment standards. Japan has nothing like our right to a jury in criminal cases. The law requires that states honor rights traditionally important in our country, even if the legal traditions among our friends overseas differ. We did, after all, rid ourselves of the British monarch, in part because he tried to take our guns away. Chicago also relies heavily on policy arguments, claiming that gun bans are effective tools for fighting crime. We disagree, as do many other people. But in the end, the Supreme Court is a court of law, not a court of social science. The Constitution must be enforced even, and perhaps especially, because government officials don't think it's a good idea to do so. If the people decide the Constitution contains a bad policy choice, they can always amend it. For now, the court must protect our constitutional rights, and it should do so by confirming that Chicago must respect the right to keep and bear arms.